This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the fourth week of January, and this week the impeachment trial of Donald Trump got underway. The first day was devoted to procedural questions. Would witnesses be called to testify and when? The House Democrats leading impeachment argued with the president's attorneys. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer moved repeatedly to seek witnesses and documents. Each of his motions was defeated on a party-line basis. A handful of Senate Republicans say they are open to witnesses, but they want to wait until after the extensive presentations from the House and the president before they decide whom to call and how. This order of events has precedent. It's how witnesses were handled during Bill Clinton's impeachment 21 years ago. But before we get to that stage, the senators are supposed to sit and silently listen to 48 hours of presentations spread over six session days, a structure that is keeping the Senate quite unusually in session 6 days a week and on Tuesday well past midnight. To talk about the trial, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Elizabeth Brunig of the New York Times. Hello.
Hi, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
Liz, have the Democrats been making a compelling case for the president's removal?
So Democrats have been making the case that they have, and I do think they've been making the most of the evidence that they've been able to pull together. Republicans obviously are not cooperating in fact-finding, which means that there are some limitations on what Democrats are able to marshal in their favor. And there are other reasons that Democrats are maybe hesitating to pull as much testimony in as they could. But that being said, removal is a really high bar, and I think that Democrats are going to have to demonstrate a bit more than they have so far to really put that case over the top.
I mean, I think the case they're making is compelling, but it's not new. It's the same case that we have known in broad strokes since September and October, that the president misappropriated the foreign policy of the United States for his own personal purposes. He sent his own personal attorney over to Ukraine to make demands that were explicitly not on behalf of the United States, but on behalf of Donald Trump personally. And he used resources that are at his disposal as president, the ability to host meetings, a resource that technically was not even legally at his disposal, withholding aid that he was legally obligated to disperse to them because Congress had appropriated it. He nonetheless did that. He did it for a personal purpose. And so I think we know this, but the case that the House managers are making is maybe necessarily duplicative because these facts, I mean, we've filled in a few details here and there, but mostly this is stuff we've known for months. So I think it's sort of foreseeable that this is not going to change a lot of minds.
Right. I would say Adam Schiff, I don't have a huge lot of regard for, has really been quite effective. I mean, he's a really good prosecutor. He's head and shoulders above all the other House managers. And if they just had 6 hours to make their case and it had all been Adam Schiff, I don't think they would have lost a thing. Maybe gained a little because the rest of it's pretty numbing. And I think they've been strongest making their case for the witnesses. They've been weakest making the case for why they didn't try to go get the witnesses themselves. They're strongest saying that this happened and this was wrong. Weakest saying that the only way you can hold them accountable is to remove them. So it's a process that doesn't really have much drama at the end of the day because we know what the ultimate outcome is going to be, which is why the media is focused on this subsidiary question of witnesses, where there is a little drama because we don't know what's going to happen with that. And you can count at least three Republicans who you can see voting for witnesses next week, but you need four, and it's hard to know who the fourth would be. So it wouldn't shock me. I don't know how the witness question is going to turn out, but it wouldn't shock me if he's acquitted by the end of next week.
Do you have a sense of what those internal politics are among Senate Republicans? Because, I mean, the four names, if there are going to be four Republicans who demand witnesses, it presumably is going to be Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, right. Mitt Romney, and Lamar Alexander.
Right.
And Lamar Alexander is sort of talked about as the biggest wild card. He's a very senior politician, a Senate institutionalist. He's also close with Mitch McConnell. Do you have a sense of, I mean, because when Susan Collins talks about this, she basically says she wants to hear from witnesses, but she wants to follow this process. To what extent is that sincere, and to what extent does that really have four Republicans behind it? Because it sounds, I mean, the White House appears to be acting like they expect that Republicans may force witnesses to be called.
I don't know how sincere it is. The way it's set up, it quite possibly could have a very Senate result to this, which is they'll just be a vote on whether they should have witnesses. And it's possible you get four Republicans for that. Certainly Susan Collins is going to vote for that. But then you'd actually have to have a vote that can be amended on which witnesses you can have. And that's where you can see kind of poison pill amendments to, say, a measure saying we're going to have John Bolton, you know, calling for Hunter Biden or Joe Biden. I would think Democrats should take a Hunter Biden, a John Bolton trade in a minute. I mean, Hunter Biden's sort of a sad sack, but all he knows about Ukraine is that he got paid a lot of money for not really good reason. We already know that. Plus, people probably feel sympathy for him, at least Democrats that matter the most for Joe Biden at the moment, whereas John Bolton was at the center of this, and his what he says will be played up as one of the most explosive piece of testimony the last 10 years, and you can easily guess he's going to be very harsh about what the president did here.
Liz, what have you made of this trade discussion, which Joe Biden ended up shooting down later in the week? I mean, I understand the logic of what Rich lays out there, but I think if this were a court trial, you wouldn't call Hunter Biden because Hunter Biden is not a relevant witness. He doesn't know anything about the president's behavior here. And so I think that, you know, to the extent Democrats are taking this seriously as a trial, to agree to that, you know, for political reasons, I think, you know, it creates a sideshow, which is one reason not to do it.
It does create a sideshow, but I feel like the Bidens are in a position at this point where there's no way not to have a sideshow, because it also creates a sideshow to refuse to address what's going on with Hunter Biden and what has happened with Hunter Biden, you know, especially as the trial wears on, along with the Democratic primary, more and more questions about Biden and corruption are going to come up. They've already come up. People do have questions about Hunter Biden, and the Bidens sort of resolutely trying to suffocate this by refusing to address it head on, I think only adds fuel to the fire and the sense that there's not a lot of transparency around what's gone on with Hunter Biden. So is it sensible to have a Biden for Bolton trade? You know, I don't really think so for the reasons you point out. It's not going to add a lot to the impeachment proceedings, but holding Biden back and refusing to address these issues around corruption directly is also going to have an inflammatory effect, I think, in the long run.
I don't know about. I mean, so Liz, yeah, your first column at the New York Times, first of all, congratulations, is on these issues, and I think you lay out a number of good arguments about things that, you know, Hunter Biden getting appointed to the Amtrak board when he had no apparent expertise that was related to that, except that his father was the vice president. And there are these issues. The problem is that the stuff that President Trump has accused the Bidens of doing is completely separated from anything that the Bidens actually did. It's basically a made-up account of what Joe Biden was up to, pressuring people in Ukraine to shut down investigations when Joe Biden was actually pushing for a more robust anti-corruption push in Ukraine. And so the problem is that, you know, I think you're right that there are real problems surrounding Hunter Biden's lobbying activities, and then, you know, we can also talk separately about stuff related to Delaware banks and that sort of thing. When you allow that discussion to be combined with the president's essentially made up discussion about what the Bidens are up to, it grants legitimacy to conspiracy theories and nonsense that the president is throwing at them. I certainly understand why the Bidens are unwilling to engage in that.
I understand that as well, and I think that you know, Joe Biden has good reasons for not wanting to go down this road. But I think the issue is that it's difficult for voters to distinguish between the good reasons for not wanting to discuss and discount accusations of corruption and potentially bad reasons. That's one of the successful parts of this campaign of Trump's against Biden, is that it has introduced the issue onto the record. And the issue of Biden's corruption, as you point out, does have ridiculous and unfounded aspects to it. But then it also has aspects that are much less ridiculous and much more worrying. So for the Bidens, it's going to be a matter of trying to address this, I think, in a way that helps voters distinguish between those two. And at the end of the day, I don't think there's an answer that the Bidens can give that's going to clear the whole thing up.
Rich, do you think the president's getting this to stick? I mean, it seems like an effort to replay the Hillary Clinton playbook. The difference is that, you know, Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton had a four-decade track record to build on that sort of made it easy to stick accusations to them. I think it's harder with Joe Biden.
I think that's right. Yeah, Hillary had 30 years of being radioactive there that made it easier for people to believe the worst, certainly for Republicans to believe the worst. I do think we'll hear more about this. I don't think Joe Biden himself is corrupt or pressure to fire this prosecutor for corrupt reasons, but he does represent kind of the worst aspects of our public life, which is people around famous and prominent people get rich for no very good reason. And this is true of Hunter. It's true of other people around Joe Biden. On the question of relevance, I think there's enough relevance for Republicans to hang their hats on to say they want Hunter, because it's become an issue. Was there any legitimacy in wanting to investigate Burisma? And the House managers say no, and the White House team says yes. So Hunter has some relevance to that.
But it seems to me the question is not could there have been a relevant reason to ask the Ukrainians to investigate the Burisma issue. And I think the answer to that is still no. But the better question is, did Donald Trump have a valid reason for wanting them to do that? And so the idea that Donald Trump did this out of a concern about foreign corruption, Donald Trump is literally out there saying that the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act should be repealed because it is an unfair disadvantage to U.S. businesses that they are not allowed to pay bribes abroad. Right. So even if you could, and I think it would be extremely thin, to say that it was an appropriate U.S. policy priority for the U.S. to push this specific investigation of corruption in Ukraine, that was obviously not Donald Trump's priority. If he was making that claim, it would have been an obvious pretext, because the president is objectively pro-foreign corruption.
Yeah, and he focused on this because of Joe Biden. That's obvious. But a White House team is making the case, and I think they're wrong. They're saying it has to be a crime involved in impeachment. You can't impeach it over a piece of power. That's wrong. But they're making the prudential case, I think, is stronger when they say no presidential impeachment ever has not involved bright line violations of criminal law, and that's not here. And then when it's not there, you do get into a murkier area of subjective intent.
I read your column on this week. You said that removing the president over this would be insane. And it seems to me that your argument here is self-limiting. You basically say that, you know, it would be insane to remove the president in part because, the public opinion about it is so close, it would be incredibly divisive and poisonous to our politics. But those, of course, are also reasons that the president will not be removed. Because the public opinion is so divided, you cannot marshal Republican votes for his removal. If Republicans were voting to remove him, it would be because he was extremely unpopular and it would no longer be so divisive. And so, you and your colleague Ramesh Panuru at National Review have split on this. And Ramesh says that this, the political fact that the president won't be removed is actually a reason to be more inclined to impeach over these issues, to say, what is the risk here? Do we want more elected officials to go on the record to say that using the resources of the federal government for these personal purposes is improper? Or do we want fewer saying that? So, what do you say to the fact that because of this, this exact political limitation, that makes the impeachment a more reasonable choice because it sends a message about what the president did?
I think that's reasonable. Everything Ramesh believes is very reasonable on any given issue. I disagree on this. I just don't think this is the only way to hold him accountable or the only way to get people to say it was wrong. In fact, by upping the stakes of it, at the margins, you might have even fewer Republicans being willing to say it's wrong because they fear the consequence would be a slippery slope to removing him. But you expose what happened. You make a public case. It's wrong. There are all sorts of other things you can do. I may be the only one in the country who believes it's bizarre to invite the president, who you think is such a dire threat to the public interest and to the nation that he must be removed tomorrow, to come into your chamber for a majestic setting to give his view on the state of the world. Why it seems to me you would first not invite him, then try to, the next step up the escalation ladder would be trying to remove him. So there are all sorts of inner branch comedy. You can deny him and you can censor him without getting yourself in the ridiculous position of really saying you want him removed 10 months before the election. And this will be the backstop. Like for the next couple of days, we'll hear the only way to hold him accountable is to remove him. When he's inevitably not removed, they'll say, oh, he was held accountable because he was impeached, because it's a form of censure. So I think the lesson of the Republican impeachment that was very similar in a lot of respects, had a no-hope impeachment in the Senate, and this one is that this isn't a good model, and it's better if you want to censure a president just to censure them.
Well, Liz, one difference between this impeachment and the Clinton impeachment 21 years ago is that while the polling is not strong enough to actually lead to the president's removal here, it's a lot stronger than it was then. You're polling in the high 40s saying that the president should be removed instead of closer to 30. And so I'm wondering, do you think that this has been a useful exercise? Do you think that it acts as a significant censure of the president? You said at the outset of this discussion that Democrats would need to do more to push their case over the top. What else is it that they could or should have been doing that you think would have moved more of public opinion, made this a more effective accountability measure for the president?
I mean, it's difficult because it's a protracted process. As you pointed out, it's taking place over several hearings and many hours. So it's difficult for the average voter to sit down and watch it in its entirety. I think Nancy Pelosi, in her handling, played it pretty smart. I think in general, the public is well-ish informed on what the core issue is. There probably could have been a little bit more effort on that front at clarifying what Trump is actually guilty of and the ways in which it is and isn't distinct from the other bad things that everyone already suspects him of. But in general, I mean, that's the challenge the Democrats have here, is sort of getting across to the average American not only what happened, but why it's a big problem and how it fits in with the Democratic narrative about Trump being, in general, a sort of corrupt, self-serving leader who's putting American foreign interests at risk with those habits.
Let's take a break. I'll be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Elizabeth Bruning of The New York Times to talk about public opinion and the 2020 race. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Bruning, columnist at The New York Times. When I say I don't think the impeachment proceedings have changed many minds, I'm not just making an anecdotal observation. Polling on impeachment has been remarkably stable. There was one big move in October when House Democrats said they would proceed with impeachment. That move coalesced nearly all Democrats and an increased number of independents around the idea that Donald Trump should be removed from office. And since then, not very much. The 538 tracker shows support for removing Trump hasn't budged from the 47 to 49% range over the last 3 months. To talk about public opinion on impeachment and also the state of the 2020 election race, we're joined now by Ariel Edwards-Levy, reporter and polling editor at HuffPost. Hi, Ariel.
Hi.
So do I have that characterization broadly right, that this has been very stable since we started this process in October?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think when we saw the real movement on impeachment was way back when the Democrats in Congress finally decided, okay, this is an action that we're going to take. And at that point, you did see, especially among Democrats, but even outside of the party, opinions swinging toward impeachment. And since then, basically, it's sort of ossified on very familiar partisan lines. And at this point, you have this fairly what looks like an immovable status where Democrats basically are wholeheartedly for impeachment and removal, Republicans are against it, and many of the people who might still be persuadable, which there are those people, but they're also the least likely to be paying attention at this point in the process.
And it seems to me like this is part of a broader trend, that the president's own approval rating has been remarkably stable throughout his presidency. Most presidents really have significant moves up and down in approval. The president has moved in a very narrow band. He's been unpopular, but he doesn't get a lot more and less unpopular. Do you have a sense of what the reason is for that? Is there a structural change in American politics that means that people don't change their minds as much? Is it something specific to Donald Trump? What's with all this noise in our politics? What is with this sort of weird stability in the political situation?
I think that there are a couple of reasons for that. One is, I think, something that underlies even Donald Trump, where you saw this with the Obama administration and even a few administrations before that, which is that increasingly opinions are polarized. There was a time in American history where a president could have majority approval among the opposite party. And it's very, very, very hard to imagine that happening at this point. You know, the last election was the first time in a very long time that we'd seen two unpopular candidates running against each other rather than two candidates who were generally liked. So there's this sort of real partisan stasis that's hard to work off of. The other thing beyond that is that I don't think we've seen any of the sort of events that might actually cataclysmically shake up a president's approval. You know, there hasn't been a gigantic economy crash. There hasn't been a gigantic foreign policy event or some sort of, you know, God forbid, act of terrorism, something like that. So you haven't seen anything that's sort of capable of breaking through that stasis.
Well, I mean, there was a scandal that was significant enough that it led to the president's impeachment. I mean, I think with a normal president, wouldn't we think of that as the sort of cataclysmic event that might move these numbers?
Yeah, that's true. And I think maybe one way of characterizing that would be to say something that breaks through that partisanship, whereas this is something where your opinion of a scandal about President Trump, I think, is going to depend a great deal on what your opinion of Trump was before that. And, you know, maybe that itself is a sea change in American politics, but I think that's where we are right now.
This stability strikes me as missed opportunities on both sides. I mean, first, Rich, to look at the Republican side, the president presides over an economy that is objectively quite strong, that subjectively people in surveys report an unusually high level of satisfaction with the economy. It's remarkable to me that over 3 years, the president has failed to seize opportunities to turn that into greater popularity. And some of the things, you know, sometimes when Democrats will talk about this, they'll propose things that would be very unpopular with the Republican base. You know, it's not that he should have embraced Obamacare, or that he should have, you know, done some comprehensive immigration reform. Not that he should have done those things as a political matter, I mean. But there are other things. He could have done some big infrastructure package. You know, right now he's talking about, as he always does, about maybe we're going to have another tax cut package. And it's going to end up being something that will be DOA with Democrats in the House. He could instead attach himself to something like the Romney-Bennett proposal to further expand the child tax credit. That's something that you could conceivably get through a divided Congress that you could then wave at voters as a tax cut for the middle class that has improved their lives. He seems to have no instinct at all to find these ways to get the Democrats on the wrong side of wedge issues, do things that would be popular with more than just the 40%, 42% of the country that says they like him.
Well, the first key to budging his numbers would be acting more presidential, which he's not capable of and doesn't have any interest in doing. And then it would be taking advantage of his heterodoxy, as you say, to pursue some interesting legislative alternatives with Democrats, or at least wrong-footing them by making proposals a Republican usually wouldn't. And he does have an instinct towards doing this in theory. He just doesn't have any idea of how to carry out in practice. And the only initiative that really qualifies is he did get a lot of Democratic votes, as we talked about last week, for the USMCA. But otherwise, he just hasn't been able to carry off anything.
And then the flip side of this for Democrats, Liz, is that I think that they sort of look at Trump, who they see as this obviously horrible president in person, and yet they can't seem to get his approval rating under 40 in the last 2 years.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a signal of something that's going on in American politics writ large. I think it probably has a lot to do with the ways in which Democrats have approached Trump voters. I think that those efforts, while well-intended by Democrats, have kind of produced their own increasingly strong resistance. So every sort of overture Democrats make to try to diminish Trump's support ends up kind of inoculating Trump supporters against further modes of persuasion. I think another problem is that Democrats themselves are torn on how to handle Trump supporters. I think some Democrats feel like we the left, ought to try to win them over and convince them to support left candidates. But other Democrats feel like these Trump voters are just reprobate sinners, and we shouldn't be trying to win them over because incorporating them into a Dem base would be toxic.
Another area where we're seeing this unusual stability, I think, is the Democratic presidential primary. The different polls will vary here and there, but if you look at the polling averages, Joe Biden has not at any point given up his lead in the polling average. Ariel, what do you think is the state of that race right now? People are talking about a Bernie Sanders surge, and he has moved up in the polls, although he is still in the 538 tracker, 7 points behind Joe Biden in the national polling. Yet you have prediction markets that give Bernie Sanders nearly as high a chance of winning the nomination as Joe Biden. So is this a stable race with Biden in a comfortable lead the whole way, or is it less stable than it looks?
I mean, prediction markets will never be my choice for looking at sort of where to start measuring the state of the race. I think what's happening right now is we're in a place where it's very hard to tell what's going to happen. I think, you know, Joe Biden, the majority of polling still shows him up ahead. There's a lot of polling, especially in Iowa, that indicates that it's very, very, very close, and that I don't think, you know, any of the top tier of candidates there, which is Biden, Sanders, and then Warren and Buttigieg, anyone pulling that off, I don't think would be a total, total surprise. What you do see, I think, and that the one thing that polls have been consistent on is that this is a race with enormous potential for volatility. What you see is that people are considering multiple candidates, that a lot of people are not completely locked in. And so I think, you know, Iowa looks at this point like it could really go in any number of directions. And I think once we see what happens in Iowa, there is a lot of potential for things to reshuffle. You know, I think Biden comes in with the advantage of having been some degree of a front runner for a very long time now and not really seeing his numbers budge that much. But at the same time, I think it's pretty easy to imagine a scenario where, you know, he's not a strong enough front runner for that to actually carry through once people start voting.
Liz, do you think Bernie's position is stronger than the national polls would indicate?
I think there's a chance of that. I think that the national polls are, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic about them. Let's put it that way. There's always concern about a candidate sort of peaking early on. But I think this is actually pretty good timing for Bernie running up to Iowa. Things are looking good in New Hampshire and California. And so, you know, I think it's worth being optimistic about. Like Ariel said, there's a lot of potential for volatility here. You can see that Biden is ramping up attacks on Bernie. He's going to, I think, pivot next to Bernie's record on guns. And also, Bernie is ramping up attacks on Biden where it comes to corruption and entitlement cuts at the exact moment that those issues, at least corruption, are central to the impeachment trial. So there are a lot of open questions here.
Ariel, another way in which the polls are moving is that Mike Bloomberg, who's spent like $250 million on national advertising so far, has been moving up in the polls as a result of that. He's taken fourth place in the 538 tracker, outpacing Mayor Pete Buttigieg. What do you make of the growth of that support? What does it tell you about the way that ad money matters for polling? And does it add up at all in terms of a strategy to, because he's not running in the first four states, to somehow overtake the other candidates on Super Tuesday?
It really is fascinating. And Bloomberg and, you know, Tom Steyer also, it almost seems like, you know, a ready-made science experiment on the impact of money in running in these primaries. And it does show you that, you know, in a primary like this, where getting your name out and getting a slice of the public attention is so crucial that you really can buy that to some extent, I think. You know, at the same time, look, I'm never going to count anyone out, especially after, you know, going through the 2016 primaries. It's hard for me to imagine that strategy being something that gets you not only at the table, but actually carries you through, especially once people start tuning in earnest, which is, you know, just starting to happen now for, I think, the majority of primary voters are only now really starting to very seriously consider their options. So I don't know if that's enough of a strategy to actually win, especially if you're not competing in early states.
The race is, at least in the national polling, is quite stable at the top in terms of Biden, but there's been significant shifts underneath him. And the one that's happening now is Bernie is clearly on the rise. It's entirely plausible to see him winning Iowa and New Hampshire, and in which case that's an enormous step towards winning the nomination. The internals in some of these polls show that Democratic voters crucially view him now as kind of a normal Democrat. There's one of these polls that had Democrat voters saying they'd be basically exactly as excited and or concerned about Bernie winning the nomination as they would Joe Biden winning the nomination. There's a CNN national poll, might be a little outlier, had Bernie actually ahead in the horse race, but also had him ahead narrowly among non-white voters over Joe Biden. He's strong among Latinos. He's strong among young African-American voters. So if I were Liz, I would be very optimistic about what might transpire here.
What do you make of the Bloomberg phenomenon, Rich? Because the president has been reacting to it. Mike Bloomberg bought an ad on Fox and Friends, and his campaign manager was on Fox and Friends, and the president got on Twitter to attack Mike Bloomberg. And, you know, there's two things here. I mean, one is, you know, Mike Bloomberg is richer than the president. Maybe it annoys him to be tweaked by him. But the other thing is that Bloomberg has signaled that he's going to keep spending money even if he's not the nominee. So this could be a key part of the strategy to take down the president with any candidate for the Democrats.
Yeah, so I think people tend to overestimate just how much you get from needling Trump. And the Bloomberg line the other day is some people say, you know, there are going to be two New York billionaires in the race. Who's the other one, you know, besides me, which is another great line to get under Trump's skin. But at the end of the day, doesn't get you much. But, you know, 500 million or whatever would be the number of negative ads counts for something. I have to say, if Bloomberg is still a real factor come Super Tuesday, and it's a Bernie Biden race, I would think Bloomberg's effect would have to help Bernie, right? I mean, you'd think Bloomberg would be taking votes from Biden rather than Bernie. And another thing about the Bernie scenario, you know, he doesn't have to get to 50%. He just needs to have a couple more delegates and some more votes than anyone else if it gets to a contested convention. And it's going to be difficult or impossible to take it away from him.
Liz, Rich mentions Bernie being perceived as basically a normal Democrat by Democratic voters. It feels to me like there's a big split there between the electorate and the professional class of the Democratic Party. People who are Democrats for a living really care about whether you're a member of the party or not in a way that ordinary voters may not care. And of course, we saw Hillary Clinton deciding to speak up here and saying, well, first of all, declining to commit to support Bernie if he's the nominee, and saying nobody likes him, which is a manifestly untrue claim. But it seems to me that she speaks for some fraction of at least the party institutionally, and maybe some fraction of the electorate, although certainly not most of the electorate, as Rich notes there.
Yes, and she was, I think, being as truthful as she ever is, when she said nobody likes Bernie, which is true in a certain respect. None of the super rich people that the Clintons associate with socially like Bernie. That's all true. And those are also reasons that ordinary people do like Bernie. And so I don't think it's going to be harmful for him ultimately to have Clinton go on the record like that. What could be difficult for Bernie is if Obama decides to go on the record as having serious reservations about Bernie. There has been some reporting that suggests Obama is contemplating that. We know that Bernie isn't really the kind of candidate Obama seems fond of, and that he probably would prefer somebody else, be that Joe or another Democrat in the running. But if Obama decides to come out and sort of publicly push back on the Bernie ascendancy, that could be a real issue, because I think rank and file Democrats do favor Obama quite a bit and do respect his opinion quite strongly. So that's an outcome that I'm a little bit concerned about in terms of Bernie's chances. But Hillary's issues with him and trying to fire up ordinary Democrats about Bernie having been an independent, I think those are dead ends.
I'm skeptical of that reporting about Obama thinking about coming in with a warning against Bernie. I mean, that came from Charlie Gasparino at Fox Business. And Charlie is very well sourced with people on and around Wall Street, including with Democrats who are on Wall Street and are active as Democrats. But the sort of people that he would have been talking with about that, I'm not sure that they're reliable narrators of what Obama's thinking. It may be a little bit of wish casting. I'm sure that there are Democrats on and around Wall Street who wish that Barack Obama would do that. I don't necessarily take that as a claim that Obama's thinking about doing that. I also think if Obama wanted to involve himself in the race, there would be no reason for him to do it on the terms of, I don't like Bernie, stay away from Bernie. He would just endorse Joe Biden, his former vice president. And I think it's sort of telling that he has chosen not to do that so far.
Well, the split you asked Liz about between the establishment and actual voters goes to why a desperate stop Bernie campaign, if it comes to that, say if he wins Iowa and New Hampshire, it's perfectly possible Biden could win both. But might have the same effect of the desperate stop Trump campaign in the Republican primaries, which didn't work, in part because there was a split and average voters didn't view Trump with the same alarm that the elites and the establishment did. Another analogy is that you would think there's a lot of material to work with. And the kind of Democrats I tend to see are, you know, former office holders and these establishment types. And they just think he's going to be nuked by super PACs with all the stuff, you know, honeymooning in the Soviet Union and all that. But we thought we had tons of material against Trump as well, and voters just didn't want to hear it.
Yeah, Ariel, what do you make of that when people talk about electability and they try to figure out the strengths and weaknesses of these candidates based on where they're polling in the primary right now? Is there any way to adjust for attacks that haven't been aired in a primary? I mean, because there are certain things like, you know, Bernie Sanders is for decriminalizing illegal entry into the United States. That is not a flashpoint in a Democratic primary. That's something that you'll hear a lot more about in a general election. Of course, maybe there are also things about Joe Biden. You will hear more intense attacks related to Hunter Biden and some of the corruption issues that Liz highlights than you've heard in a Democratic primary where people are playing nice. Is there any way to figure out which of these candidates are actually in the stronger position for a general election?
Oh God, I think that's so hard. And I think, you know, it's plausible to make an argument for pretty much any candidate, you know, either positively or negatively. At this point, I think any sort of general election polling is kind of a blunt instrument. You know, what it can tell us right now is that it looks like a general election matchup is going to be close, especially in battleground states. It tells us, you know, that there might be some variation between how different candidates play out, but you're not seeing something where one of the top tier candidates is just notably, like, you know, running like consistently like 30 points ahead of everybody else or 30 points behind everybody else when pitted against Donald Trump. So I think it's hard to look at that and say, you know, we can price in what attacks are going to work. If people knew how to do that, it would be a whole lot easier to run campaigns. And I think when you look at the electability question among Democratic voters, it's also a little complicated because on one hand, Joe Biden has consistently had an advantage if you ask who is the most electable candidate. On the other hand, I don't think most Democratic voters see electability as a zero-sum game. When we've asked them this in surveys, what we found is that most people think that there are multiple candidates who have the ability to win. And you see something like about a quarter saying that they're voting for a candidate who they think is going to be more electable over their favorite candidate, but the majority saying, no, I'm going to vote for the person who I like. And they may consider that person to be the most electable, but it's not clear that which way the causality is running there when they're making that claim.
Still with me are, on the left, Liz Bruning of the New York Times, on the right, Rich Lowry of National Review, and also Ariel Edwards-Levy of HuffPost. And now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters, or maybe 280, to distill the spirit of the week. Liz Bruning, what's your Tweet of the Week?
After Hillary Clinton went on the record with The Hollywood Reporter savaging Bernie Sanders, saying nobody likes him and she just feels bad that everyone got sucked in by his baloney, my colleague at the New York Times, Ross Douthat, tweeted, "Nothing learned. Nothing forgotten."
Rich Lowry, what tweet struck you?
My tweet is from a guy named Alex Griswold, and he is tweeting about a report that Dmitry Medvedev and the entire Russian government were resigning, and Alex commented, "Wow, the Astros scandal is bigger than we thought."
Ariel Edwards-Levy, what's your tweet of the week?
My tweet is from reporter Ben Walsh, and it said, "A rough three-tier power ranking. Level one, there are people familiar with your thinking level. Two, you have you have close associates. This may also mean you've been indicted. Level three, you have an eponymous, quote, world."
My tweet of the week comes from Joe Perticone of the Bullpen Strategy Group in Washington. He says, "It might shock you given the current political climate, but this is the single dumbest thing Congress is doing right now, and it's a bipartisan effort." He's talking about an effort by Jim Risch, the Republican senator from Idaho, and Tammy Baldwin, the Democratic senator from Wisconsin, to crack down on things called milk and butter that are not actually dairy products, because apparently people are confused about whether soy milk is a milk product or not. This is what the government is working to protect you from. I've been talking with Liz Bruning of the New York Times, Rich Lowry of National Review, and Ariel Edwards-Levy of HuffPost. We will be back to talk about whether the presidential candidates are being too nice. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at the New York Times. And Ariel Edwards-Levy, polling editor at HuffPost, is also with us. So, Liz, we previewed your Times column a little bit earlier in the show than I had intended. But as we noted, your column relates to certain attacks that you think that Bernie Sanders ought to be making on Joe Biden about his record of coziness with certain business interests and about activities that his son seems to have gotten to do because of his association with Biden. I want to talk about sort of the broader point in your column, which is basically that, you know, Bernie shouldn't be pulling punches. And, you know, when we compare this to some past presidential campaigns, you can look at, you know, what Obama had to say about Hillary in 2008. One of my favorite examples from 2012, Mitt Romney sent a cake, or at least said he was going to send a 15th anniversary cake to Newt Gingrich, celebrating the 15th anniversary of his citation for ethics violations by the House Ethics Committee. It seems like this has been an unusually nice Democratic primary campaign, and I think you're arguing that means we're not hearing all that we need to hear about the differences among the candidates.
Right. And in particular, I mean, so I do think it has been an unusually nice Democratic primary. I think you can measure that even by the money People are not spending a lot of money on negative ads. I think so far there have only really been two that you could argue are negative ads, that were paid and produced advertisements, not just clips people tweeted out. And that's a pretty big change from 08, where Hillary and Obama really fought it out quite viciously with ads on the radio and TV. But I think there's a big desire, because Trump is in office, for Democrats to kind of take it easy on one another and not commit to attacks that are so brutal they could compromise whoever ends up going to the general against Trump. Because there is still a lot of belief among Democrats, and I don't agree with this, but there is belief among Democrats institutionally that Bernie's attacks on Clinton, which were also very mild in 16, are what did her in against Trump in the general. Clinton certainly believes that herself. So I think everybody has kind of walked on eggshells, and that's a little bit ridiculous, because as you point out, and I agree, and I posit this in my column, there are really concerning issues, with a lot of the front runners in the Democratic race. With Biden, those are issues of coziness with donors in the financial industry, the credit card industry specifically, and also issues around sort of corruption, or at least questionable ethical dealings regarding his son. And if those are not breached in the primary and tested in the primary, then they're going to be brought up in the general, because these are known issues. We know Trump knows about them. So we can either see how voters are going to respond to that now, or we can see how voters are going to respond to it later. But I think now is the time. And Bernie, you know, he doesn't like going negative. He's a vision issues oriented guy. He doesn't like talking about personalities or individuals, but he's going to have to, because the very things that he's against are manifest in his opponents here.
Well, so Ariel, I'm interested in your thought on the last bit of what Liz said there, which is sort of that it's not Bernie's personality to want to go negative here. And so I'm wondering, has he pulled punches because of his personality, or has he pulled punches because it would be a strategic mistake to punch? I mean, and my sense is from the polling that the Democratic primary electorate is actually unusually satisfied with this field of candidates. They tend to like a lot of candidates across the field. And so is that maybe why we've seen a less negative campaign? Because there's little appetite for that among the voters. They like a lot of these candidates. They're trying to choose among good choices. And if somebody starts talking about how bad somebody else is, that will just redound badly on the person making the attack.
Yeah, we have seen that Democratic voters generally are very happy with the state of the electorate, and they generally like multiple candidates. You know, you'll see that somebody who likes Biden and likes Warren and likes Sanders. I think another factor here is that it's still a pretty crowded field. So we're not yet at that stage where you have two candidates duking it out. And when you have something with this many candidates, I think that there's sort of an idea that the effects of a negative ad might be a little unpredictable. You might end up with, you know, two people go head to head. They end up damaging each other. And then, you know, a third person ends up taking advantage of that. So I think that when the dynamics of how that's going to impact the race become sort of complex with so many people still in the running, that might add up to some of the hesitation as well.
It's funny, Rich, how this plays a little bit differently in Republican primaries. And I, you know, especially as I watch on Twitter and the sort of kumbaya sentiments of why can't all the candidates get along, as a former Republican, I find that kind of weird. And like, you know, no, this is a fight. They should fight. But on the Republican side, you had this different dynamic in 2016 where people didn't want to fight Trump, not because they were afraid that fighting would look bad, but because they were afraid that Trump would just hit them back too hard. And then you get all this stuff with like Chris Christie viciously taking out Marco Rubio, head of the New Hampshire primary, which does no good for Chris Christie. But you do see what Ariel identifies there, the multi-candidate field dynamics, where it can be, you know, it would be good for someone to attack the front runner, but no one wants to be the person who's going to do it.
Right. In a multi-candidate field, a war between two candidates often benefits someone else besides the two candidates. I'm with Liz in theory and the abstract. I have no problem with politicians attacking one another. In fact, I enjoy it. I think negative ads usually add, despite their bad reputation, add important things to the discourse. But with Bernie in particular, just personally, this just isn't who he is, especially on any extraneous issue that doesn't have to do with substance. So it's not surprising he apologized for an op-ed that wasn't written by him or his team calling Biden corrupt. And it had echoes of that famous debate moment with Hillary where he said, I don't give a damn about her emails, which might have been a good tactical position for Bernie to take, but I'm sure it was also really sincere. So if Bernie wins this thing, it's going to be by being Bernie and doing it in a really unorthodox way. So if I were him and his team, I'd be really hesitant to get him off brand in any way.
Well, so I think to Rich's point, Liz, Bernie seems more comfortable taking a different line of attack against Joe Biden, which is questioning his record on Social Security and saying that at various points in his career, Biden has been open to cuts in Social Security. Biden has been pushing back very hard against that.
Right. And Bernie, you know, I think, again, just by disposition and having this wariness around negativity has also, I think, moved off of that a little bit in ways he shouldn't have. His campaign released a clip of a 2018 video of a Brookings speech that Joe Biden gave, in which he appeared to praise Paul Ryan's efforts to cut Social Security and Medicaid. Joe Biden's campaign called the clip doctored. It wasn't. It was just truncated. In that particular statement, it appears Biden might have been being a little bit sarcastic or something like that. But in the very next breath, in the very same speech, he argues for, quote, adjustments to Social Security and seems to suggest means testing it. According to his own economist, Jared Bernstein, those are cuts. Those are euphemisms for cuts. And so Bernie's campaign, you know, shouldn't have backed down. Bernie should have said, in this speech, you were talking about cutting Social Security as recent as 2 years ago. And that's absolutely true. I think that there's a big chance that those attacks will land with voters in Iowa, especially older voters that Biden has been really successful with. And they should, because Biden does have this history. The Wall Street Journal's Ed Board has praised him for it as recently as this week. And that should be concerning.
So I think the history of this is interesting. I mean, this is one of these issues where Biden's been around in Washington for more than 40 years, and so there's a lot of history. And there were times when there was bipartisan energy for entitlement cuts. I mean, in the Reagan administration, there was a big bipartisan package that raised Social Security taxes and cut benefits by raising the retirement age, and that had a lot of support across the political spectrum. You had an effort by Barack Obama to look for a so-called grand bargain on fiscal issues where Obama was willing to do entitlement cuts. But I think the key difference between the 1980s and 2010 is economic conditions. You had a different interest rate environment where interest rates were very low. There was political pressure for deficit reduction, but there wasn't the true economic pressure for deficit reduction that you had in the 80s or the 90s. And then that was why in the 80s or the 90s it was possible to bring Republicans and Democrats together to cut entitlements and also to raise taxes in a lot of cases. And so while Obama was in theory willing to do entitlement cuts, in practice the reason the deal didn't get made was because the price was too high. The things that that Obama was demanding in exchange for those entitlement cuts, Republicans weren't willing to give up, and vice versa. So I think, you know, I think the lesson here about the difference between Biden and Bernie is that if we had a big shift in economic conditions where there was real economic pressure for deficit reduction, Biden would be a lot more willing to go to entitlement cuts in that case than a president like Bernie Sanders would be. So I think that's where you could have real daylight between them. I don't think if the economy continues as it is that you're likely to see differences in policy that gets made around Social Security between the two of them. Because Sanders won't be able to get an expansion of Social Security through Congress, and Biden won't face the sort of pressures that would lead him to be willing to cut it. But I think, you know, it's an interesting theoretical case. If you're president for 8 years, things could change a lot. But before we go, I want to talk about Kamala Harris. Kamala Harris is in the New York Times this week because the Times reports that she is thinking about endorsing Joe Biden, but she hasn't decided yet. The Times says, quote, Democrats close to Ms. Harris say she wanted to carefully consider the potential impact of her endorsement, was mindful that two of her female colleagues, Senators Amy Klobuchar and Elizabeth Warren, were still in the race, and was uneasy about the prospect of backing a candidate only to see him or her lose in California, unquote. So, I mean, first of all, the calculating nature of this, like trying to figure out, you know, well, what endorsement endorsement will do best for me politically. And then the fact that that calculation ends up in the pages of the New York Times, the people close to you are talking to the paper about the fact that you're making this political calculation. It sort of seems to go to me to like everything that was wrong with Harris and the campaign, the sort of lack of any core of ideology that ended up not only showing her to be, you know, willing to go wherever she wanted, but it undermined her political appeal. People didn't know what she was. And so I guess the question is, you know, if she was going to do this, it would be because she's trying to get on the ticket with Joe Biden. Would she even be a good running mate for Joe Biden? Would she add political value given all the political missteps she took in the campaign?
I don't think so. I think she's highly overrated as a political figure. I think what you say about this episode going to her weaknesses in the campaign is absolutely right, including that it showed up in the newspaper. And when you had these just jaw-dropping leaks prior to her dropping out in the race about the internal divisions in her campaign, it was really the kind of the death rattle. So I think she would be kind of a check-the-box choice for Biden in terms of demographics.
What do you make of that, Liz?
I think that's right. I think that pulling Harris onto Biden's ticket from Biden's point of view would be a positive insofar as it could be an inoculation around some of the negatives he has with women. He already does pretty well with black voters. So I don't think that that's what he would be looking for. But there's no question that Harris' campaign was quite inexpertly run on a variety of levels. But on the other hand, I do think that she's a good fit for Biden in that neither of them really appear to have principles. They just kind of move around in terms of whatever is going on at the moment that's going to keep them where they are comfortably situated.
Ariel, do you have a sense, do vice presidential picks matter? If you are a U.S. senator trying to position yourself to be picked for vice president, or if you're someone who thinks you're going to be the nominee trying to pick a running mate, how do you figure out what move actually helps you win the general election?
I think this is one of those questions that's always a little tricky to answer because it ends up being something like, it doesn't matter a huge amount. It can matter at the margins. And if we have something like 2016, it's an election that's going to be decided at the margins. So you end up in this place where everything matters a little bit. And I think, you know, potentially, you know, the home state thing is probably not as big of a deal as people want to think it is. What you can see in effect is if the vice presidential candidate is vastly more popular or more unpopular than the person at the top of the ticket, then they can be either, you know, something of a bomb or they can drag down, which, you know, something like Sarah Palin maybe in 2008. This time around, I think, you know, you're going to see candidates looking for someone who can sort of balance out their weak points. I could see a case where that could matter at the edges. But until we know, you know, obviously who the nominee is and sort of what they're needing to balance out to face against Trump, it's a little hard to know whether that's going to be, you know, the game changer of the election or just something that adds on to all the other factors that are going to go into this.
Ariel Edwards-Levy, reporter and polling editor at HuffPost. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Neither Nancy Pelosi or Mitch McConnell are shedding any tears over this, but it's kind of crazy that with less than 2 weeks to go before an Iowa caucus that may do much to define our national politics over the next year and perhaps beyond, three plausible candidates have to sit all day in Washington drinking water or milk, listening to an impeachment trial that everyone knows the outcome of.
Liz Brunig, what's on your mind?
This week, popular podcast host Joe Rogan endorsed Bernie Sanders, or at least said he's going to vote for him. Now, a lot of people on the left side of things were distressed by this because Bernie cut an ad with the endorsement and thanked Joe Rogan for it. Joe Rogan, who's an MMA commentator, and a lot of his views can probably be seen as pretty right-wing. Bernie should lean into these endorsements, and he should readily accept the support of people who are not typical Democrats. That's what it's going to take to win.
For my rant, unlike Joe Rogan, the New York Times was not able to settle on one candidate in the Democratic primary. They endorsed two candidates. They endorsed Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar. I don't think that newspaper editorial board endorsements serve an important purpose to begin with. A disembodied editorial board is not who voters look to tell them how they should vote, at least in very high-profile elections like presidential elections where voters have a lot of opinions of their own. I think it's great when newspapers endorse for who you should vote for on the municipal water board, things like that, where maybe you're not paying a lot of attention and they do all the boring research to figure out who's well-qualified. But for president, I don't think people are really looking to the paper, and they're especially not looking to the paper to say, hey, we are in a disembodied board of many people with diverse political opinions who couldn't agree. Yeah, no I mean, that's how groups of people with diverse points of view are. You can't settle on one endorsement. Maybe you should make zero. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Liz Brunig, and Ariel Edwards-Levy. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is Kat Yore. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.